Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Reaction is pouring in from around the country today after news broke that the controversial Keystone XL pipeline will not be finished. The Canadian company TC Energy said yesterday it was canceling the project. The proposed 1,200-mile pipeline would have carried 800,000 barrels of oil from Canada through Nebraska and then on to the Gulf Coast each day. But it faced years of opposition from environmental groups and Indigenous people. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi joins us now. Ali, welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
Now, this is big news, but once President Biden took office in January and revoked the pipeline's construction permit, the writing was kind of on the wall, wasn't it?
That's completely right. It's big news. It's not unexpected news. The building of this pipeline, the announcement about this pipeline, riled a lot of people. First of all, property owners, because it was a Canadian company that was basically going to use U.S. eminent domain rights to take ranch land and farmland from people. And I think TC Energy, which used to be called TransCanada Pipeline, did not see this coming. It was a bit ham-fisted. They assumed if they make a deal with the U.S. government, they'll take care of getting all the land they need. Then there were issues about this pipeline going through in Indigenous lands, and a lot of Native Americans were very concerned about that, and they paired along with people who were environmentalists, generally against not just the use of fossil fuels and oil, but this particular type of oil, which comes from the oil sands. It's a very energy-intensive way of getting oil out of the ground. It's plentiful, but it's particularly dirty.
But it's not just a matter of giving in to activists, though, as you point out there. I mean, the industry has been shifting away slowly from fossil fuels.
Yeah, and the oil sands used to be this massive. I mean, you can see it from space. It's just this pit of literally, if you go into it and you pick in your hand, it's dark dirt and sand and oil, and they have to boil it using natural gas, which is why it's so dirty. But then it becomes normal oil like any other oil. That used to be seen. It was the Saudi Arabia of North America. It was the source for all our oil. But now, through activism, through environmentalism, through conscientiousness about the environment, even the oil companies are saying we're going to find other ways to do this. Bottom line, though, oil from Canada, specifically from the oil sands, was the biggest sort of pot of oil that America imported last year, much bigger than the Middle East or Venezuela. So it still will be an important source. It's just not going to come through this pipeline. There are still lots of thousands of miles of pipeline in the U.S.
Right. Well, that's why the industry is saying that this will be a big hit to U.S. energy security. Is that right? Do we need this pipeline?
Well, we still ship a lot of oil around. Over time, we will need it less. If you don't use pipelines, and there are already pipelines, but if you don't use pipelines for the extra oil, you use trains. Those can be very dangerous as well, as we saw in Quebec a few years ago, these trains that are right. 100 or 150 cars. So this is not going to stop oil from moving around the country, which is one of the concerns. But it will, when you use those trains are not available for grain and wheat and things like that. So there are lots of economic effects of this down the road.
CNN went to South Dakota, where business owners were hoping to cash in on this flood of pipeline workers. They were distraught over this news. Trisha Burns owns the Ignite Gym. She'd invested thousands of dollars to expand that business, and she's devastated. Let's listen.
So, you know, the old saying, you got to make hay when the sun shines, and we felt like the sun was going to be shining, and we needed to take advantage of that. And then the executive order started coming in, and when he signed the bill to pull the permit, it was a tough, tough moment here at Ignite.
Just about a minute here, Ali, but what kind of economic impact does losing this project actually have on these communities that were in its path?
Yeah, they were going to be very excited about this because for a short time, it was going to bring a lot of people into work. They were short-term construction jobs. In the end, it doesn't take people to run a pipeline. There would probably be 50 full-time jobs, but it would take a few years to build, and those people would have come into a number of these small towns. So that's going to be a hit for those places.
Is that it for this pipeline? Is there any chance it could be revived?
It'll be hard. Everybody's going to have to think this through a lot better, map it out a lot better, and the opposition to these pipelines is greater now than it's ever been. So I think it'll be several years, if at all.
All right. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi, thank you so much as always.
My pleasure.
Well, oil proponents and Republicans on Capitol Hill slammed President Biden after the news. Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming said Biden killed the Keystone XL pipeline and with it, thousands of good-paying American jobs. Analysts are saying maybe not that many jobs, as we just heard, though, a gym owner who had people cancel memberships. Robin Rorick of the American Petroleum Institute called this the result of political obstructionism and a blow to U.S. energy security. As Ali said, environmentalists and indigenous activists are rejoicing, even hoping that the Keystone cancellation could spur the end of another pipeline called the Enbridge Line 3, which would carry Canadian oil across Minnesota. Larry Wright Jr. is chair of the Punkah Tribe of Nebraska, one of the many Native American groups that fought this pipeline. Chairman Wright, a bitter battle lasting more than a decade. Your thoughts?
It's just a relief. Quite frankly, so many people from water protectors, the pipeline fighters, environmental groups, the tribal nations, Republican and Democrat, independent. You know, this really saw a coalition being brought together for 10 plus years. And, you know, people call this flyover country, but this is where we live. You know, we can empathize with lost jobs in the short term, and we understand that. We've seen that in other places. But, you know, truly, to hear people's stories, land that was being lost or threatened of eminent domain, and as a leader of a tribal nation, you know, tribes are ground zero for what knowing what it's like to lose land by eminent domain or otherwise, broken treaties. And so we understand that, but at the same time, we all live as part of this, as part of Mother Earth. So it really is a great feeling.
So you're listing treaties that would have been broken, land that would have been taken. You recognize that some jobs, some income, some attention in the area might be lost without a pipeline going there, but you think that's a trade-off for, you know, future environmental benefits. Talk more, though, about that land, especially being an indigenous person. What is on that land? In some areas, we know that there are sites that are sacred. What else is important about the land?
Well, I think everything. I mean, you know, it's truly what sustains us. And the food that's grown, the water that we drink. And last I checked, you can't drink oil. And so, you know, the negative side effects of a spill outweigh the economic aspects. And I'm sitting here right now close to this land in Nebraska that the pipeline was scheduled to cross. And I'm staring at wind turbines and looking at that clean energy. And so those alternatives have far greater benefits, less impact on the land itself, and that's really what it's about.
Wind turbines and sun power, solar power, those are grand, but it's going to be a while before they can make up for the power that comes from fossil fuels, and that, you know, it's just going to take time. So in the meantime, you also need gas to power automobiles, to power electricity. What do you say to those who say, we need this for energy?
You know, to an extent, that's true. But when we look at this particular pipeline and what it was meant, you know, every indication that it was being piped from Canada through the United States and to be exported. And so from an energy standpoint and self-sufficiency for the United States, you know, I think those arguments fall flat. At the same time, we see technology grow, and investment in that technology is needed. Infrastructure built around that is needed. And the sooner we invest in that and make that a priority, I think just like everything else, it becomes cheaper.
Well, Chairman Wright, we know over in Minnesota, indigenous leaders like Winona LaDuke are fighting the Canadian company Enbridge and their plans to put in a pipeline known as Line 3. And in fact, just this past week, protesters took over a construction site there. Will you be involved in that fight? Are you involved in that fight? What do you hope might happen next?
firsthand, I'm not, but I totally support the efforts that they have to bring awareness to that. And it's not different in scope and the environmental impact that it could potentially have with an oil spill than what has happened here with KXL or the Dakota Access Pipeline, et cetera. And so it's continued awareness of the impact that these things have on the land that it crosses and those people that live there. And so while it may be in a different location, the argument's the same.
That's Larry Wright Jr., chairman of the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska. Chairman Wright, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Again, the Canadian company TC Energy saying it will cancel the Keystone XL pipeline project. TC Energy saying it will now coordinate with regulators, stakeholders, and Indigenous people to ensure a safe exit from that project. If you spend time in just about any neighborhood, you've probably seen plastic signs in bright white or neon yellow attached to utility poles and along freeway exits with big, bold print that reads, "We buy houses," or "Fast cash for homes." We saw them on several walks through Cleveland's 8th Ward on reporting trips. Well, Justin Glanville from member station WCPN in Cleveland met up with a guy who's on a mission to tear those signs down as a way of stopping what he calls the exploitation of his neighborhood.
We buy homes as creepy as this sign. Dollar sign, dollar sign, dollar sign. Dollar sign, dollar sign, dollar sign. It's mine.
One morning a few weeks ago, Brandon Kirsch was out to breakfast with his girlfriend. She had a volleyball game afterward, so Brandon decided to walk home.
And in those 8 blocks, I came across 8 of these signs, and I said, well, you know what? I'm gonna tear that down. And so before you know it, I kind of look like this lunatic walking down the street, climbing over fences and like guardrails for cars to rip these things down around I-90.
The 36-year-old data analyst has kept at it ever since. He's on a self-assigned mission to rid his neighborhood, the southern part of Ohio City, of signs that he sees as taking advantage of low-income homeowners who don't think they have many other options.
You know, I use the phrase strip mining our neighborhood, the reducing the stock of available homes. They're profiting extremely off of the perceived value of this neighborhood. And while they're doing all of these things that negatively impact the neighborhood, they go around and they're nailing these signs, basically trashing up the place. Let's take a right here.
On a sunny Saturday, he invites me to join him on a collecting expedition. Brandon takes long, purposeful strides. Underneath his short, dark hair, his eyes scan for those hated rectangles of corrugated plastic.
So we're at the intersection here at West 44th and I-90. There's an exit ramp. There's a sign over there. It's going to be a little dangerous, but I'm going to go take that down. Watch yourself.
The guardrails and utility poles framing the exit are like a sign party. Signs stapled on top of other signs, even, all jostling for the attention of drivers.
So this is pretty beat up from the wind. It looks like it's going to come down really easily. I'm just going to reach up there and give it a yank. There's another one right underneath of it. They're both mine now.
After about half an hour, Brandon's arms are full. He walks me back to his townhouse, where his garage floor is already covered with signs from previous hauls. He thinks out loud about why this has become a way he spends his time.
Throughout the winter isolation and having nothing to do, I spent a lot of time just cleaning up the inside of the house, fixing it up. It's really nice in there, and I'm really, really happy with what we have here. So now I'm looking at what's next. How do I improve my house next? Well, it's not an improvement in my house. It's an improvement in my neighborhood. This cash for house stuff, to me, is a really big problem for somebody. You know, that's not a little trash in their yard. That is a keepsake that's been in their family for generations that's now being stripped of them. So when I pull out a sign, I feel slightly better about myself. It was really satisfying.
And Justin Glanville of WCPN joins us now. Justin, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Great to be here.
Well, and you know, we saw these signs in Ward 8 in Cleveland as well. People see them across the country. Is it even legal to post these?
Yeah, in most cases it is not. But it's not because of what the signs say, but where they're posted. So telephone poles, which are one of the places you see them most often, those, of course, are owned usually by cities or utility companies. So putting anything on private property like that is illegal. And then even in tree lawns and guardrails, those are also places that are usually owned by cities, so it's illegal to post signs there either. But you don't see these rules enforced too often. I'm sure, Robin, you've seen political campaign signs pop up in all of those places during elections, and those folks are obviously not usually getting hauled into court.
Yeah, it sounds like these signs are aiming for people trying to hold on to homes. So who are the companies behind the signs?
I did happen to talk to two guys in their 20s named Andrew Dunn and Tyler Powell. They met in college and just started their company Capital Growth Group last year. And Robin, Andrew Dunn told me that while his company is not for everyone, he knows that, he sees the We Buy Houses signs as a way to reach people who don't have a lot of other options.
It's maybe someone who is about to foreclose on their home, or the repairs have gotten to a point where they simply can't afford to do that. We can offer a solution to that person. You know, we can buy their house in cash in a reasonable amount of time.
And aside from the signs, he and Tyler also cold call people and knock on doors looking for people who want to sell their houses.
However, you spoke to people who say there's other options?
Yeah, a lot of people would say that working through a company like this is not the best way to sell your house if you're looking to get out from under it. For example, if you have inherited a house and you can't afford to keep up with the repairs, a lot of folks would say that the best way to get a decent price on that house would be to work through the traditional real estate system. A lot of housing advocates also told me that you've got to think about the effect that selling at these really low prices have on the surrounding neighborhood. Because when you sell a house for a really low amount, that then becomes a comparable sale for appraisers who are looking to give values to other homes. So it can really bring down the housing prices and the sales prices for a whole neighborhood.
And you also found out there may be programs in your area that might help you pay that mortgage rather than have to sell the house.
Right. Like here in Cleveland, we have a program called the Healthy Homes Initiative, where every neighborhood has a representative who works for the city who can help you get access to capital for things like putting a new roof on your house or getting new paint or windows.
And there's also a cautionary tale here, because you spoke to someone who actually bought one of these homes through a different company, not the one run by the two young men. They didn't have that great an experience.
Yeah, so, and that's kind of the other side of the situation. So I spoke with a woman named Shalonda Dixon. She bought the house for $500 down, and then she paid $500 a month for it. She kept up with those payments to the LLC, and she thought that they included her property taxes, but it turned out that they did not. So she owed $12,000 in back taxes. Fortunately, she was able to work with a neighborhood group to stay in her house, but she says she really wants her story to be a cautionary tale for folks not to get caught up in that dream of owning a home.
Justin Glanville of member station WCPN in Cleveland, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
All right, let's take a closer look now at a key part of the Biden administration's climate plan that could affect neighborhoods like the one we just heard about. It's an investment in environmental justice to protect poorer communities that are disproportionately hurt by pollution and climate change. This week on Capitol Hill, one of the president's Energy Department nominees had her confirmation hearing. She'd have to implement that plan. We're re-airing this profile of Shalonda Baker, who brings an activist voice to the administration's climate efforts. Here's NPR's Jeff Brady.
Shalonda Baker is a former Air Force officer, a law professor, and a leading advocate in the emerging field of energy justice. Baker sees energy policy as the next domain for advancing civil rights. Here she was at a virtual Earth Day event connecting the police killing of George Floyd to energy.
And I would suggest to you today that the energy system is not immune from that broader reckoning, and that in many ways, the energy system is complicit in the structural violence that is routinely experienced by people of color in this country.
Baker says people of color too often are subject to the downside of energy development, like pollution from burning fossil fuels, and rarely get to experience the upside, such as jobs and owning power plants. Even more unfair, she says, poor communities spend a larger share of their income on energy. She and other energy justice advocates want to fix these problems through government policy. For Baker, that begins with involving affected communities in energy planning right from the start. In an online interview, she told celebrity activist Jane Fonda about her experience working in Mexico and Hawaii.
People didn't understand why a law professor was talking to grandmothers and aunts and uncles about energy. And I believed that those voices needed to be heard in the energy policymaking space.
The Department of Energy declined NPR's request to interview Baker now that she's been nominated. She already works at the department and is being promoted to director of the Office of Minority Economic Impact.
It's a unique position with the U.S. government because it's one of a kind office.
James Campos held the position during the Trump administration. He's critical of how fast the Biden administration wants to transition to cleaner energy. Still, he says this director position is important as the country becomes more diverse.
The growth of the minority communities, the impact the minority communities will have upon our economy, and the need to be inclusive at all levels.
Campo says part of the job is bringing more people of color into the energy business. Mustafa Santiago Ali says one way to do that is to make sure more of the billions of research and development dollars the Energy Department allocates make their way to a broader range of colleges.
There were certain academic institutions that were the ones who received the lion's share.
Ali worked at the EPA for more than two decades and now pursues his environmental justice work at the National Wildlife Federation. He'd like to see more federal money flowing to historically black colleges and universities, Hispanic-serving institutions, and tribal colleges.
So if we want to grow both the next set of engineers and scientists and a number of others, then we have to be investing in the infrastructure that would exist inside of those entities.
The Biden administration goal is that 40% of benefits from federal money spent on climate change should reach disadvantaged communities. If Shalonda Baker is confirmed by the Senate, part of her job will be to make sure that happens. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
What happens to police officers who get caught stealing, lying, or tampering with evidence? Each week, we open up an internal affairs investigation that used to be secret to find out how well the police police themselves. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
We got a ruling from the Supreme Court today. The justices said that a man with a felony record for reckless aggravated assault was sentenced too harshly in a later guns crime conviction. The opinion could have wider implications for criminal sentencing, and it was a 5-4 decision. Justices Neil Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas joined the more liberal justices as swing votes. Let's bring in Emily Bazelon on to tell us what it means. She's a fellow at the Yale Law School. Emily, hi.
Hey.
Tell me about this case and how the justices ruled.
Yeah, sure. So this is a case about a law that Congress passed and that President Ronald Reagan signed in the 1980s. It's called the Armed Career Criminal Act. And it says that if you are someone who possesses a gun illegally and you'd previously committed 3 violent crimes, then you get 15 more years on whatever criminal sentence you're going to have. So basically, it's a way of saying people with serious violent felony records who then possess a gun go to prison for a long time if they are tried in federal court.
Why does it matter?
Well, it matters because, you know, we're in this era of, to a degree, rethinking mass incarceration and who should have really long sentences. And so what happened in this decision was this unusual coalition of judges, of justices, looked at this law and they said, what kind of state of mind do you have in order to qualify for this 15 years extra on your sentence? And the petitioner in this case, Charles Borden, he had committed 3 crimes, but one of them was for reckless aggravated assault. And so recklessness is not necessarily deliberately doing something. And so what the justices said was that given that it was recklessness, which is more like a kind of negligence sort of finding as opposed to deliberate action, that he should not get this extra 15-year sentence.
What does it say to you that Justices Gorsuch and Justice Thomas joined the liberals?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Justice Gorsuch talks about himself as being very closely bound by the text of a statute. And so the first thing that Justice Kagan, one of the liberals who wrote this opinion, said was, we are following the text of the statute here. And with Justice Thomas, he similarly is basing his separate opinion on a close reading of the text of the statute. He just picks like a different phrase to focus on. But it's all this notion that they're adhering very closely to the statutory text.
I see. Well, we are still waiting on a lot of opinions. This was just one of them, not the biggest one by any means. We're looking at healthcare, voting rights, adoptions in gay families. What are the big ones that you're going to keep an eye on?
Yeah. So this question of whether the Affordable Care Act will be upheld, even though there's a challenge to the notion that it no longer has a tax in it because Congress zeroed out the individual mandate. That's a big one. There's a big case that has implications for voting rights. It's coming out of Arizona. Then there's a case from Philadelphia that's about whether the city can say to a Catholic social service agency, we're not going to contract you with you for foster care or family services because you discriminate against LGBTQ people. And so that one is a big one for LGBTQ rights. And then the last one is about kids using social media. There's a high school student who cursed on social media. She got suspended from school. Is the school allowed to do that?
More to come later this month. Emily Bazelon, fellow at the Yale Law School, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Every so often we revisit this next topic, and young parents are shocked to find there's naturally occurring arsenic in rice. This time our look is prompted by news that baby food maker Beech Nut is voluntarily recalling some of its rice cereal because it contains more arsenic than federal guidelines allow. It's a recall that comes 4 months after a congressional investigation found high levels of arsenic and other heavy metals in a number of baby foods. Beech Nut also said it will no longer sell its single grain rice cereal because it's too hard to find rice flour with low enough levels of naturally occurring arsenic. So let's get a reminder again about this with Scott Faber, Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Scott, this recall comes after Alaska found samples of Beech Nut's single grain rice cereal had what's called inorganic arsenic. The word inorganic has nothing to do with how it's grown. It's a chemical word. It had levels above 100 parts per billion, which is more than the FDA allows. So why is there any arsenic in baby food through rice?
Well, anytime you grow rice, there's a chance that the plant will take up arsenic that's in the soil, into the rice, and ultimately into your baby's body. There are ways to reduce the amount of arsenic that's in rice. You can change where you grow the rice. You can change how you grow the rice. But it's very hard to completely eliminate arsenic from rice and ultimately arsenic in infant rice cereal.
Yeah. So there are certain levels that are allowed. Beech Nut is admitting that it went over, even though it was trying not to. People are aware of this. How concerned, first of all, should parents of young children who've been eating this product be?
Well, the short answer is very concerned. Arsenic in rice can impact your baby's brain. But the good news is there are plenty of alternatives to rice-based cereals or rice in baby foods that provide all of the same nutritional punch. There are other grains, multigrain cereals, oats, as well as other foods that are great first foods and that don't present all of the same risks as infant rice cereal.
Well, by the way, should adults be worried, or is it just infants we're concerned about because their brains are forming?
You're exactly right, Robin. Because our babies' brains are in this really incredibly important developmental stage, it's really dangerous that there are high levels of arsenic in rice-based cereals.
And by the way, white rice, which is less nutritional, has far less arsenic. We understand because what white rice is rice with the husk off it, which is, you know, more nutritious, but that's where the arsenic might be.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why making baby food at home or making baby food with brown rice isn't really a solution. Ultimately, the solution is for the federal government, the FDA, to set tough standards that companies have to meet, that companies have to require their own suppliers to meet, so that you don't have to worry, or certainly you don't have to make your own baby food at home because you know the government's the cop on the beat.
But there are some parents who are particularly concerned here because their children need more rice products. They can't eat other products. And so, you know, they desperately want this available.
There are certainly cases of people who, you know, can't avoid rice because of limits in their diet. But the important thing is to make sure that your baby's having a varied diet. Provide a variety of different foods, especially first foods, so that you're ultimately reducing the overall amount of arsenic that might be entering your baby's body.
Yeah, because children who have celiac disease, for instance, they might be eating, you know, I'm reading 14 times more arsenic than other kids because they are so dependent on the rice.
Yeah, you know, and that's really troubling. Again, ultimately, the solution isn't to completely eliminate rice in our baby's diets. The solution is for the government to set tough standards that baby food companies have to meet and drive down through their supply chains. When we did that for arsenic and juice, we saw a huge response where companies changed where they produced the apples that went into the juice, the varieties of apples, and saw a quick reduction in the amount of arsenic that was ultimately in apple juice. We can make the same progress with infant rice cereal and other rice and baby foods. We just have to set the standards and challenge our baby food companies and the farmers who supply them to meet those standards.
Scott Faber is Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Scott, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
To Colorado now, where it is fire season, and a dangerous one at that because of a prolonged drought. Last year, summer wreaked havoc on Colorado's forests, but some indigenous students from Denver are drawing on the techniques their ancestor developed generations ago to prevent future fires. Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundine traveled with eighth graders from the American Indian Academy of Denver to the site of the historic Hayman Fire.
Nearly 20 years ago, on this very spot, just southwest of Denver, winds were howling, temperatures soaring, and a fire was burning so hot it burned ground cover to black soil. Today, middle school students in black hoodies walk up the mountainside. It's really hot today.
Can I have some water, Ray?
And though it's been nearly 20 years since the Hayman Fire, there's still no ponderosa pine or Douglas fir. But science teacher Creighton Hoffeditz tells the kids to look for what is on the land now.
Are there trees? Are there bushes? Are there plants and wildflowers?
They're getting help from drones. Meadow Yellowhawk is flying a drone over the fire-ravaged land.
Yeah, you can see that.
Do I have to keep going up if
no.
I wanted to stay there?
Yeah.
It's part of her science unit on wildfires. The American Indian Academy of Denver, just in its first year as a middle school, has a STEAM curriculum. That's science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. Founder and head of school Terry Bissonette says indigenous principles and knowledge are infused throughout the curriculum.
We've been scientists, builders, innovators, artists, mathematicians since the beginning of time.
Many other STEAM schools are about getting kids ready for the jobs of tomorrow.
It's that, but it's really about reclaiming the genius of our ancestors.
And she says bringing it into a 21st century format so kids can see its relevancy. Student Rose Leba says take wildfires.
Back when indigenous people were still on their land, they did practice controlled burning.
She says Native people set up a perimeter and burned within it, clearing out underbrush. New plants would grow back, replenishing the forest. When white settlers arrived, she says the practice was to suppress wildfires at all costs. Without the periodic fires, the forest lost an important control mechanism. Experts say the forest in the Hayman Fire was unnaturally dense. For their unit, the students studied how indigenous views on wildfire are starting to influence fire management strategies in places like Australia and California. Back at the drone controls, Meadow Yellowhawk describes what she sees.
It looks dry.
But she is seeing new plants that weren't in the forest before. There's yucca and sage. Science teacher Creighton Hoffeditz.
I just want them to understand the process of regeneration and healing of the land, and what makes that possible, what makes it not possible.
Students are also checking out the soil. Joe Ortiz and Sean Demarius dig a hole, add water, and form a mud ball.
It was very sandy. Lots of grain, not much clay like we were hoping.
Yeah, it like fell apart when you squish it.
Joe says the intense heat of the fire, coupled with climate change, left the area without any moisture. The fire was so hot, it eliminated the seed bed.
I saw a lizard.
Me too.
You too?
Teachers encourage the kids to explore today. They want these city kids to develop a relationship with the land. Some kids climb higher up the mountain. They like the fresh air. They discover moss on rocks. They're on the lookout for wildlife. The kids say they're more comfortable at this school than other schools they attended. Just 60% of Indigenous students graduate from Denver Public Schools. But at the academy, Indigenous students say they finally feel like they belong. Here's Alex Wolf.
I like going to a smaller school. It just feels like you're less lost and like forgotten.
And student Joe Ortiz.
You feel like kind of a safe space because you're with people who are like you.
Students say they like learning about Indigenous traditions and knowledge. Rose Leba.
If we don't have anyone to keep carrying these traditions on and telling these stories and being able to teach the future generation their way, it's just going to die out and then we're just going to be nothing special.
Go smell it, Meadow.
Before heading back to Denver, a teacher motions the kids over to smell the sap on a ponderosa pine in a healthy part of the forest. The kids crowd around the tree and breathe in deeply.
Oh, I can smell it now.
For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Brundine.
This is Here and Now. So here we are, more than a year after COVID-19 first swept across the globe, and states are allowing businesses to reopen, including gyms, which were once a red zone for the virus. Our producer, Marcel Hutchins, went out and found some happy, sweaty people at Gymit, her local fitness club in Boston.
Obviously, I'm coming a little bit more now, just because I've been vaccinated, so I feel a lot better about it.
To get into the gym, I want to get back to working out.
This is a very safe place, very comfortable. And after I'm done, 1 hour most, I stay here. I feel it's just wonderful.
The pandemic forced millions of Americans into virtual gyms, so what's going to happen with them? Let's bring in Mark Santamaria. He's the National Director of Group Fitness for Crunch Fitness. It's a chain with more than 380 gyms around the world. He's based in New York City. Mark, welcome. Good to have you on.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I don't know about you, but it was very nice to hear the sounds of a gym in the background there, hearing those people talk. It feels like we're kind of getting back to normal here a little bit. But what happened at your gym? I imagine it's the same story as it was all across the country, all across the world. Things shut down?
Yeah. God, I remember the date clearly. It was March 16th here in New York, and we were told to shut everything down last class. And I have to admit, there was a lot of hopeful ignorance or optimism in the sense that many of us who were in a leadership position said, it's going to be fine. We're going to figure this out. We're New Yorkers. We're tough. So there was a big, big learning curve those last 2 weeks of March last year.
Well, and I know it wasn't fine in so many ways, but what about for your gym? I understand that sales today are nowhere near where they were pre-pandemic.
Yeah, so the gyms shut down. New York quickly shut down. You know, full-time employees were kept as long as they could. And then by May and June, the bulk of our staff were put on furlough as well. So then we pivoted. The pivot was the big word. I have never heard the word pivot so much. So we had outdoor gyms all of a sudden wherever we could. Shopping
online
malls
gyms
and parking garages. Online became that right away. There was no holding back on that because we knew we jumped on the bandwagon right away. In March, it was like home shot videos from our instructors, sometimes with their heads cut off because they weren't used to filming things. But as you'll see, as the months went on. Oh, yeah. Well, in the sense of people's filming, now instructors have studios built in their homes, even tiny apartments, like a space dedicated just for filming online content, online workouts, and hosting Zoom classes live. Like, that's just grown in levels of professionalism and levels of availability.
Well, look, it's been a rough year, no doubt about it. You've laid that out. Let's not dwell in the past, right? Because we want to be hopeful about the future. And we heard those gym goers there at the top telling us, you know, now that we're vaccinated, we're back at the gym, we feel safe. Are you starting to see that too? And how are you convincing people to come back?
As soon as our gym in particular opened up 2021, we were trying to take advantage of that new year energy that's usually there, where there's that influx of folks jumping in. It didn't quite happen. So by, I would say, March, we had another little small wave of folks coming in. By April, and definitely now by like last month in May, huge turnaround, because we were allowed to stop wearing masks if we were fully vaccinated, right? That level of trust has been growing, and we've started to see some people joining up.
Oh, are you using the vaccine passport there in New York City?
So we really stood by and said, hey, let's trust each other. You don't have to show your passport showing that you got the two things. And there's a lot less masks that are coming on in our gyms, for sure.
But people had a lot of time to form new habits in lockdown. They might have gotten used to working out from home or even on their own, not going to a gym. Just wonder if Absolutely. You think that trend is going to stick around. And if it does, what does that mean for you?
It's the online workouts are for sure staying. I think, though, you know, there's been a lot of sort of talk like, will gyms get back to where they were going to go and where they wanted to be? And my answer is yes. For those of us that are still standing, I'm so happy Crunch is still up and running and staying strong, because folks for sure want to go to a designated space. Not to mention the variety of class options when you go into a big box gym like ours. You just look at the options there, and it I think folks crave that. The folks that might have built a little mini gym for themselves realize that, okay, it's good to have, you know?
And yet you say that online workouts are sort of here to stay. So how are you going to create a business opportunity out of that, so that if people do stay home, then you can at least take advantage of reach them somehow?
Absolutely. What I'm seeing is every brick and mortar gym or studio has an online component to supplement it. But again, you know, that sort of on-demand thing, we're banking on the fact that our company in particular really believes in connection and folks wanting to be together. And since we've opened up, we've seen the evidence of that. So we're banking people need the both. Yeah, they want the both. They want both of them.
Well, Mark Santamaria, National Director of Group Fitness for Crunch Fitness in New York City. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Online gyms, not for me. They may be for some people, but not for me. I'm happily back in my gym, breathing heavily. Here and Now, production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.